Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
We'll return to that story later on, but I would like to proceed with our interview of the morning. And my guest is one Zakhele Ntembu, the policy officer at the Free Market Foundation. Zakhele, welcome. And have I got your designation correct?
Yes, you have. Yes, you have. Thank you for having me. It's quite an honor.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm glad to have you. Zakhele, we're going to talk about an article written by a senior colleague of yours, and the entire title of South Africans Poor. I just want to set out some background, however, and that is the reason this article particularly resonated was because in 2 days' time we are celebrating May Day, which is a full public holiday in South Africa. And May Day, while largely has for many decades been the mainstay of communist and socialist regimes as a recognition of the day of the of workers who have always been, or it's maintained, or exploited, and particularly, you know, have to work under the conditions of a capitalist society, etc., etc. It's a day that came into being because of strikes and protests against conditions of employment and exploitation in the American industry over 150 years ago. So it had a very much a historic significance, where a great deal of most people were poor, and what work they had was exploitative in the extreme. But certainly one of the things I encountered, which was to some extent one understood part of the political zeitgeist of the time, but when South African industrial relations changed in the late 70s and early 80s, and black workers, employees were recognized under our labor law in exactly the same it's exactly the same way as white workers. Conditions of employment improved dramatically over time, the influence of American corporates and political changes and pressures, and the growth of a very strong union movement reflected in the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, which is aligned and has been formed part of the tripartite alliance with the ANC. So, Kelly, my question is this, is one hears, so every time there is a furious wage dispute, and it's occurring, I suppose, much in the public sector, because one tends to hear more about the public sector, because COSATU represents public sector unions mostly at this stage. There's still that sort of emotive reference to workers and the implication that the workers are some blue-collar workers, generally, perhaps to some extent white-collar workers, but that workers continue to be exploited and downtrodden, and that the purpose of the unions in going to bat for them in negotiations is to improve their dreadful lot in life. Now, your colleague Eustace Davey described this as the exploitation myth. Why does this myth still persist? Because I agreed with him fully that it is a myth. Exploitation does happen, but it generally is still a myth.
That is true. Yeah, I think Mr. Davey's article was firstly just amazing. You know, I also read it too, and I resonated with it deeply, because these are ideas that I, of course, share as someone who works at the Market Foundation. But I think the myth persists, and this is quite unfortunate, because in South Africa, you would think that we would have understood the fallacious nature, right? The fallacious nature of this myth, but we haven't. It persists because people think, like, they have a very distorted understanding of economics. They think that entrepreneurs, for instance, are people who are inherently out there to just exploit people. Maybe they are, right? We cannot speak to the nature and character of every other individual out there, but the general nature of how a market operates is that if you are someone who has the skills to serve another person and the resources to serve that person, I guess we can use resources and skills interchangeably, since your skills are your resources. But if you have the means of giving someone what they want, but they're unable to get themselves, this is what generates growth for you, profits and prosperity in any manner. And then you can extend this logic to saying that you have the means, you know what people want and they need, and then you get another person to be to exchange their skills to be able to serve other people's needs, right? But just sticking to the employment to the employment contract, right? Like, as you were in the legal fraternity, you would know that one of the foundational aspects of a contract is voluntariness, is the agency that someone has to enter into a contract. Therefore, it becomes pretty contradictory when people speak of exploitation when someone voluntarily agreed to enter into a particular agreement. The implication there, which is pretty insidious when you think about it, is that the people who agree to these terms are people who want to be exploited. I don't think anyone would really say with a straight face that someone willingly subjected themselves to exploitation. Therefore, if that is not the case, then the other case is that these people who speak of this exploitation myth are usually people who aren't party to these terms or to these contracts and these agreements. They are people who are speaking from the outside as third parties who aren't party to the meeting of the minds between two people, an employer and an employee. And then they speak of exploitation. And most, and I think this is the point that Mr. Davey made, right, that we should not discount, even though it may be pretty hard to prove scientifically, it is just the general culture of envy, I think. The idea that when someone is successful, they are successful at someone else's expense. The idea that the pie needs to be cut up instead of being grown. An idea that is wholly antithetical to economic science, right? Because this is something that economics figured out centuries ago, that you do not need to take from someone else for society to be prosperous. And I think jurisdictions like the United States or even some European jurisdictions have proven this to be the nature, right? They don't have as much of redistributive policies, yet their standard of life of everyone, even the poorest of the poor among them, seems to be improving compared to jurisdictions that adopt this thinking that says that profit is exploitative and certain agreements between people result in exploitation, even though those two people willingly have a meeting of minds. So I think it persists, really, if we can point it down to any reason. It's like just envy and ignorance concerning economic science.
Is it not also a reflection of I've called it archaic ideology that really just doesn't hold water anymore, and that is adhering to a centralized economy. The very reasons why our economy is not growing at the moment is because there is not enough, the government is not giving enough space and recognition and respect to the private sector to be the main drivers of employment. And behind this, you get the rhetoric, which really sounds like something out of, very much the 1950s, that you constantly still get this, the idea that workers, by virtue of being employed by people that are not the government, are being exploited. Profits are always stolen. Employment is a form of oppression. Business owners are greedy, etc. And that unemployment exists because capitalists refuse to share their goods. How in this really crazy scenario where everyone, we live in a society where there are and have been for decades protections against exploitation as much as can practically be done, and the very purpose of unions is to ensure that their members benefit from these rights. How does that still manage to cement itself, given the desperate need for our economy to grow, to grow at all, because we're growing at almost negligible rates?
That is true. I think you saying at almost negligible rates is pretty, is you being pretty kind to us, right? Like, I think we were always skirting on the edge of recession, and it is pretty ironic that we are a jurisdiction with one of the highest protections for employees and unions, as you have said. And it persists primarily, I would say, partly due to history and partly due to the reasons that I have stated, right? If you were to look at the history of the party that has been governing South Africa since 1994, it was heavily supported by Marxist organizations and is part of the tripartite alliance, as you mentioned. And the alliance is the ANC, a trade union, and an outright communist party. So it isn't really surprising that we have this type of thinking from the state in South Africa, right? Because we have had these, as you said, when industrial relations changed in the late 80s to early 90s, we then started seeing an institution of legislation that sought to protect workers and, you know, the like. And what has actually resulted, if you were to actually see this, pretty, you know, uncanny, in that with every institution of new legislation, our unemployment rate has pretty much just increased and increased. Mm. And this is something that, you know, anyone who, well, the people who were arguing against communism in the 20th century and the people who were really never communist to begin with before that have been preaching that, you know, when you artificially create conditions that would not exist outside of market conditions, you will then have consequences that you did not intend, right? Like, I doubt that anyone who instituted labor protection legislation intended for unemployment to increase. I doubt they wanted that. Mm. But that is what we are left with, irrespective of their good intentions. Mm. And I think really it is just an ideological persistence. We are governed by people who have fully bought into an ideology that has been shown to fail, right? Mm. State intervention does not work, and South Africa is proof of it through our various state-owned institutions that are just failing and our high unemployment rate, despite us having one of the best labor protections in the world. Mm. So we are a case study for anyone just who's interested in seeing the horrible effects of state interventionist policy. But unfortunately, there are members, because now we have a government of national unity, right? Members in the ANC who really is pretty much committed to this form of thinking, to this idea that the state ought to be involved in people's lives and it ought to dictate right down to contractual terms between individuals. And we are seeing the results of it, which is unemployment, because when you create, you know, a floor for wages, an instance, just using the minimum wage as an example of horrible labor legislations, when you create an artificial floor for wages, it means that anyone who cannot meet that floor as an entrepreneur was committing a crime by hiring someone. And then, as we know, people don't like to commit crimes. Therefore, what results is that people just aren't hired. Mm. And when people aren't hired, the proponents of these legislation, which is something that is pretty heartbreaking to me, is that they think it is better for people to earn no money, to earn 0 rands compared to earning 1 rand. Mm. Is the extreme example I like to use, that, like, you know, they think it is better to earn no rands than earning some form of money, which I find to be pretty insidious, because it results in the high levels of unemployment that we have that are pretty unsustainable. A ticking time bomb, as Kossatz once said.
Mm. I mean, essentially, what we're looking at is an irony here, because when one looks at the figures, generally employment in the public sector is the amount what people earn and the benefits they become entitled to are now generally greater than the private sector. And the only reason this can be done is because the government has the means to exploit the taxes that are paid by the people who largely work in the private sector. So that's the one area that's sort of points to a contradiction, that to the very thing they say. It's not merely a matter of, well, when they're not exploited in the public sector, you know, because we pay better, et cetera, but that's because they can literally, you know, budget themselves the money to do so. The other thing I've to comment on is the fact that the very often you see that repetition of that of essentially what is and it is repeated often with confidence that it is a falsehood. It applies when public sector unions are tackling the state for better conditions of employment, which are already generally on average better than the private sector. So how does one square that complete and utter contradiction, which should be obvious and should make the I suppose in a way a form of embarrassment for the ANC in particular.
That is true. Actually, like, it is a form of embarrassment as much as you believe it, which is why part of the reason why we're in the fiscal position we are in, because the ANC would be embarrassed that these public sector workers are even proposing a raise, and they would give them the raise, and they consistently give them the raise until the public sector wage bill became one of our highest expenditure items, which is second to debt servicing costs. So it is something that the ANC does, like, it seems to be ashamed of, and it is unfortunate. But as you say, like, how do we square that? Because as you mentioned earlier on, taxes are raised from the exploitation, if we're to take the actual premises of the argument of the people who are making this argument. If taxes are taken from the exploitation of people in the private sector. The state cannot generate its own funds. It needs people in the private sector to generate value, and then it extracts that value in the form of taxes, meaning by nature, people employed in the public sector are contingent on the exploitation of other people in the private sector, because without said exploitation, there are no taxes, there are no profits. Mm. There's no income to be made, right? Mm. So really, this is something that people never take into consideration. And then it is made even worse when we consider what you mentioned, the fact that we have public sector wages, public sector employees, and there are unions who consistently are pushing for higher and higher wages. And this is the nature of like self-interest, really. Mm. If you look at the world through self-interest, you wouldn't be surprised that someone would always look for higher and higher pay. Even though if you look at South Africa, I was reading a report by the World Bank whereby they said that in South Africa, we have a high wage bill, but we don't have a high employee headcount, right, compared to other jurisdictions that have wage bills comparable to ours, because the few employees in the public sector that we do have are paid so high, it is comparable to other high first world countries in the OECD, but we don't have the subsequent employee headcount, meaning that we've suffered with service delivery. We don't have the return on investment that other jurisdictions have, given the amount of money we put into the public sector. And that is due to the fact that public sector employees really have been allowed to run rampant all over South African taxpayers. They keep on getting above inflation increases each and every year. The current budget that we have right now is a budget that considers them getting an increase that is above inflation. And it will be like that for the foreseeable future, since the ruling party that is that has its minister in the finance ministry is the one that is drafting the budget, and it is in alliance with the COSATU and SACP. So really, it is quite impossible for them to see the detrimental effects that they are having and consistently just draining the fiscals of funds and giving it to public sector employees who aren't delivering the highest of, like, you know, actual returns when it comes to performance, because we all know the problems we have with service delivery in South Africa. So it is quite the contradiction that we have in SA, whereby we have public sector employees who use Marxist jargon, but they happen to be upper middle class. So really, they aren't even representative of the blue collar worker whose rhetoric they would like to use.
Perhaps the one area I would disagree slightly with the article, and that is the idea of voluntarily entering into agreement. Now, the premise is, as you spelled it out earlier, is basically correct. You know, if you have a choice, you can exercise that choice. But there isn't, in practice, there isn't really quite that parity in vast areas between employer and employee, because of the policies that have been created that have stunted development, have undereducated people, have made people less able to access the skills and the knowledge necessary to get, on the one hand, to get onto the ladder, and on the other hand, to make it more difficult for people who have the ideas and the prepared to take the risk to start a business. You know, getting into that situation where they can actually even out that level of power. And I suppose the obvious example would be perhaps in some cases, farm labor, casual labor, and domestic labor.
It is a very interesting perspective, right? And I can't, you know, even though I hear where it is coming from, but I think that we miss something when we use examples like that, because let me present another counterexample of, you know, a black middle class homeowner who happens to hire help, right? The implication that when you hire help in whatever context, under whatever conditions and terms, you are doing it in an exploitative manner, presumes that for the person who's doing the hiring to be in that position, they must have done something, or they must have been favored in any way by the state or something else. If they weren't favored by the state and they just became in a position to accumulate more resources to be able to hire someone else, then I don't think that it is just to to dictate to that person and the other person under what terms they should operate, because we are presuming that the employers are responsible for the employee not having the requisite skills to be able to get a better job, not having the amount of, you know, experience or education to be able to negotiate better terms. But that is not, you know, an employer's fault. An employer just has capital. They need someone. They are pretty much in the market looking for an exchange. And if we were to put these presumptions on them, it would be unjust, and it really leads us down the same path we are down on right now, because where will it stop, right? Where do we draw the line and say, okay, we have created enough parity between employers and employees, when inherently the relationship is not one of parity, right? One person has capital resources, the other has resources maybe in the form of labor or something else like that. And really, the parity only comes into place when these two minds meet and they exchange something that the other does not have but wants, and vice versa. So really, all the presumptions I do get the history and the context that someone may not really have a true choice, but my counter to that is I don't think it's the employer's fault. I think the default position in life is one of poverty, and when we would like moving out of that default position does not necessarily mean that one exploited some other person. Now, of course, if someone exploited another person, then that is an entirely different matter, and I think the criminal justice system should deal with it. But as a matter of policy, of economic policy, I don't think that we should favor one class of, like, for instance, employers or employees over another class, because I don't think one class is responsible for the other's position.
Well, as with most things in South Africa, the problem is multi-layered, and I think it's important. Thank you for joining me in myth busting and giving the entrepreneur, the business owner, the person who can create the business and the jobs, the respect they deserve. Zakhele, thank you very much for joining me. I hope to see you soon.
Likewise, I hope to be back soon.